You're listening to KBOO Portland.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammick and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about exciting concerts and events coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to previously aired shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm and via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House on Friday mornings, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7 a.m. right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Solar Oregon, presenting the Go Zero Tour, an annual open house style tour of net zero and path to net zero homes in Oregon on Saturday, October 4th. From 1 to 4:30 p.m. Tickets and info at bit.ly/GZT2025.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Occupation Watch with Sam Husseini, our weekly accounting of the state of the genocide now being perpetrated on Palestinians by the U.S. and Israel. Also, an alleged new Trump peace plan as outlined in a pressless conference with Trump and Bibi at the White House. Questions from the press were not taken. They were apparently used as a prop. And the Gaza flotilla continues to come under attack by the Israelis. All this and more coming up straight ahead. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Later on in this broadcast, we're going to be joined by Victor de Coria Lugo, who is a special advisor to the president of Colombia for Palestinian affairs. And he's got a great deal to say about what's happening now, the genocide, and how to resist it in terms of the role that Colombia could play and other nations could play in trying to help to protect the Palestinians. Incredibly important discussion. Again, as I said, Bibi's in town, guest of honor at the White House after a knockout speech at the UN, which led to a major walkout. Today, Trump and the Israeli genocidists held a pressless conference at the White House without any annoying questions from reporters. The reporters were seen, if not heard, as I say, more like a prop than anything else, a real farce. Sam Husseini, it is good to have you back. It's incredibly important that we're able to do these Monday programs with you, trying to assess the nature of the genocide, because we know it is continuing. But you want to talk a little bit about this peace plan and the Israeli Prime Minister at the White House today. It was quite the spectacle.
Absolutely, Dennis, and I can't wait to get to our guests, but let me give a bit of a rundown of it. As Craig Mokhiber put it, it's what they're putting forward is a de-radicalization plan for the victims of genocide, but not the perpetrators. The release of all Israeli captives, but only some Palestinian captives, and basically colonial governance by a body established by the U.S. in consultation with complicit European and Arab governments, the Blair-Kushner plan, basically, and bringing in external control of economic development via the World Bank. It's basically putting out the fire with gasoline. Trump bragged about what he's done with the so-called Abraham Accords, which made corrupt deals with Arab autocratic governments to recognize Israel and completely marginalize the Palestinian struggle. And he also bragged about moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. But those are exactly the moves that got us to this horrific state. You know, people will recall the October 7th attacks were called the Al-Aqsa Flood, the Jerusalem Flood, because they were largely a response to Israel destroying Palestinian life in Jerusalem. Netanyahu offered a pseudo-apology to Qatar for attacking the negotiators there. That's how the so-called negotiating process ended, with Netanyahu bombing, attempting to bomb the negotiators. But he basically apologized for missing. That is, he ended up killing some, you know, Palestinian, I believe, an office manager and a Qatari citizen. So he apologized to the Qataris basically for missing his target. He didn't actually apologize for doing what he was attempting to do. And not only did we have what's likely a continuation of the murderous, you know, Orwellian Gaza Humanitarian Foundation scheme, we're going even beyond that to this Orwellian Board of Peace that Trump is attempting to name himself the head of. And he's bringing in Tony Blair as a sort of viceroy, which is extraordinary because Tony Blair is most well known for being Bush and Cheney's main partner, accomplice in doing the Iraq invasion, which Trump and his, you know, America First crowd were allegedly opposed to. But I think part of what's really fascinating about our guests today, Dennis, is the timing of this. And I think that the timing of what Trump and Netanyahu is doing is largely tied to what they are working on. That is, last week we had the president of Colombia, Petro, say that he is wanting to put forward a resolution at the United Nations under Uniting for Peace with a two-thirds vote in the General Assembly. You can actually pass things that have teeth. Demands for economic sanctions, like what happened in South Africa, and even a peace force to ensure getting humanitarian aid into Gaza, which also has precedent. So that's critical. And we also have the largest ever flotilla approaching Gaza. And I believe that Trump and Netanyahu's you know, pronouncements are a way to distract. And one last thing I should point out, there's precedent for this. They're pretending to put forward a peace plan. This was almost exactly what Biden did when the International Court of Justice issued orders in the May of 2024, saying Israel had to stop its invasion of Rafah. And just then, we saw Biden come out saying that Netanyahu had agreed to a peace plan in order to distract people from this international law way of dealing with it, with the ICJ orders. And that largely worked. He basically distracted everybody into this phony negotiating process. And I think that they're trying to do very much the same thing here to distract people from getting behind what Colombia is trying to do.
Well, we're not distracted, and thanks to you, we're going to get into this in a very deep way. And before we bring in our guest, who has been working with the Colombian president on this extraordinarily, this is a proactive peace plan, I just have to ask you to remind us, Sam, in just a couple of words, what's the state of the situation on the ground in Gaza? Because the corporate networks still continue to refuse, and the corporate networks were so agreeable today that even though they were cut out of the asking any questions about the so-called peace plan, they made up all the storyline and they repeated, as you said, what we've already seen an earlier version on coming out of the Biden White House. So introduce us to our guest and why Colombia and other countries can play a key role in trying to restrain what is clearly an expanding genocide.
Sure. Well, I mean, it should be given, people should understand, even if nobody is or very few media outlets are covering it, Israel is killing anywhere between 50 and 100 people every day. Starvation is ramping up. And that's why people have just put out statements and condemning Israel and so on, but no one's doing anything. So it's critically important what Colombia is doing, and I'd love to get Victor, I assume that you're there, special advisor on the Middle East to Colombian President Petro. We'd love to find out what your plans are in order to find ways to intercede in this situation.
Welcome, sir.
First of all, thank you so much for the invitation. That we have to underline is that there is not just a proposal of the President Petro in the last moment, or there was not like a statement made in the New York Street in the last moment. We have been really committed to the Palestinian cause years ago. Just let me remember the history. First of all, we decided to send humanitarian aid. We did in 2023-24 and a few weeks ago. Second one, we decided to cut a diplomatic relationship with Israel. At the same way, we decided not to sell any more coal, not to buy any more weapons. We joined South Africa in the process leading by South Africa before the International Court of Justice for Genocide against Israel. We also, with South Africa, decided to create a Hague group to demand the implementation of the international agreement. And finally, we have been promoting the initiative that is already in the international law called Unifying for Peace. Then it's a long process. We can do it. We can do it better. Always we can do more. But we have been trying to do our best to arrive to this point. Then, let's say we were growing with the old solidarity process to arrive to the momentum in the streets of New York. This is one. Second one, as you may know, we decided to propose, we are working in a resolution draft, and we are inviting the different countries to support us. What is the meaning? The meaning is that there is an illegal mechanism, a legal provision, which allows the General Assembly of the United Nations to convoke the use of force without taking into account the Security Council. In other words, avoiding the block and the veto by USA in the Security Council. In this order, could be possible to convoke the humanity to defend beyond embargoes, beyond economical, diplomatic, political, and economical measures, beyond the boycott and other measures, the use of the force by the international community.
It's a critically important step that you're taking, and I understand that there have been a number of other measures. Many countries that have been condemning Israel are continuing to trade with Israel, so that's certainly an issue. And, you know, again, the South Africa example with the sanctions there is a great parallel. Can you tell us more what the specifics will be in this Uniting for Peace resolution that, you know, if 130 countries vote for this, then it's basically a way of to some measure of overriding the Security Council, which has been completely blocked by six U.S. vetoes.
Okay, the resolution draft is a mechanism. It's a method, not an end in itself. It means we have to see the resolution draft as another proposal to protect the Palestinian people, to be in solidarity with the Palestinian people. It doesn't compete with another initiative that already are doing the social movements, the demonstration in the streets. This kind of program, for instance, is part of this international solidarity movement with Palestine. Now, in the proposal, we have to identify as another mechanism that even it doesn't replace the other activity. We have two considerations. The first one is exactly the legal statement, the legal consideration, let's say, to justify the unifying for this proposal. It means the years and years of resolution of the Security Council as well as the General Assembly without any implementation. Also, we take into account the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice related to the war in 2004, as well as the International Court of Justice advisory opinion related to the occupation that we saw last year by the International Court of Justice, as well as the qualification of the occupation as the illegality of that such occupation. Besides, we take into account and we quoted the illegality of the settlements in the Palestinian occupied territories, the right to return of the Palestinian people, the self-determination, and this other legal consideration. Now, what we propose is, first of all, a ceasefire. We consider that it's necessary immediately ceasefire without without wait anymore, but not only in Gaza, but also in West Bank and another, including in Jerusalem. It means the ceasefire should be the starting point, not the end. Why? Because it's not just matter to end the genocide, it matters to end the occupation. It doesn't, okay, we have to save lives. Of course, it's important if we stop the genocide right now. But what about if we stop the genocide and in 2 or 3 weeks, or in 2 or 3 months, or in 2 or 3 years, they continue the killing of the civilians and the killing of the Palestinian society? In that case, it doesn't make too much sense. That's why the ceasefire is important, but it's not enough. The second point is to recognize the paralysis of the Security Council. And this is necessary because without this acceptance, we cannot jump to give the responsibility, to put the responsibility in the hands of the General Assembly. Later, we take into account that it's necessary to suspend transfer of arms and dual use technologies to Israel. In the arms embargo should be in the list of measures to be taken. Of course, we have to guarantee to push for the access to humanitarian aid, and we invite the just collective individually to take diplomatic measures and economical measures against Israel. And the last ratio, it means we are not just pushing for more violence, but we admit that unfortunately, painfully, there is not a single genocide that has been stopped because the good willing of the genociders. It's a lot of naive to pretend that Israel will decide it one day, say, oh, we decide not to kill more Palestinians, we decide to be good people. That's why we propose the use of force, but this use of force is based mainly in the protection of the civilians, to guarantee the access to humanitarian aid, and to guarantee the reconstruction of the area affected. Also, all of this, and this is my last comment in this answer, sorry for my long answer, is related to the respect of the sovereignty and the self-determination of the Palestinian people. That is totally against or in another direction that the proposal presented by Netanyahu and Trump few hours ago.
Well, let's sum up, Sam, and maybe tell people where they can get more information, how they can follow this part of the story.
Absolutely. There are a number of web pages that give people tools to get other governments to back this up. StopGenocide.com has a very good setup to help people to do that. So I highly recommend that. StopGenocide.com has a flyer and emails that you can shoot off with just a couple of clicks. To get other countries and encourage other countries to back up Colombia's effort. With respect to a protection force, it sort of dovetails with the flotilla story. Do we have
Well, let's jump. Let's go right there now. We do, of course, want to thank Victor de Correa Lugo, a special advisor to the president of Colombia, Gustavo Petro, who is going forward with this kind of plan to restrain the Israelis. I think the whole world is watching. But remind people what the flotilla is, and then bring in our guests. I think we've got Philip, we've got Jessica, and we've got you. So tell us what's going on.
There's a flotilla of over 40 ships heading. They've headed through the Mediterranean, and they are approaching Gaza. I think they just left Crete, and they are attempting to bring aid and supplies to Gaza that Israel is attempting to prohibit, as it's used food as a weapon and is attempting to basically starve the Palestinian people in Gaza. Philip and Jessica, if we have them both with us, are both veterans. They're both former Marines. And other countries have stepped in and brought in ships, indicating that they will hopefully protect this flotilla, because past ones have been attacked by the Israeli military, occasionally even killing people, and typically detaining them without any legitimate cause. So, Philip, please tell us what you're thinking and seeing right now.
Yeah, thank you again so much for having us back on last time. I think we had a bad connection, so hopefully you get out. We left Crete a couple days ago, and we're about 300 or so nautical miles away from Gaza, and there are over 50 ships from 44 countries, and right now we have a Turkish frigate escort, and there's supposed to be Italian ships as well, kind of escorting us or going alongside of us, and that's kind of where we are at the moment.
What kind of participation is there? What countries are represented, and about the latest Israeli, say a little bit more about the way in which the Israelis are attempting to undermine this flotilla in support of Gazans against the genocide.
Certainly. We have participants from over 45 countries. We have often vowed and believe in nonviolence. Participants on the flotilla, we are mothers and fathers, grandparents. I've met retirees, electricians, teachers. Almost any service industry from all of these countries are represented here, which I think goes to say, the people have spoken. We will not put up with this siege on Gaza any longer. In training in Barcelona, we got to meet all of the delegations, and it was just full of love, and we were all connected by this mission to bring this much-needed aid to a starving population.
And we also have parliamentarians aboard. We have Greta Thunberg, Nelson Mandela's grandson, and several other notable names as well. We're all just trying to establish that humanitarian corridor for government and friendly, like the Colombian government, to come in and sustain the effort of bringing in humanitarian aid like we have on board, and trying to break the siege as well.
Sam, take it.
Now it's like 3 a.m. where you are, roughly, and you're up and awake, and not just simply for us. You're on drone watch?
Yeah, we're on drone watch. I think it was a few weeks ago before we were attacked for the second time that we last spoke. That was September 23rd, and on that night, we withstood about 12 to 13 explosions. A few of the ship's sails were damaged. One of the masts of the ships were damaged enough to where that particular boat had to withdraw from the flotilla. And there were chemicals dropped as well. Our veteran boat was the first boat to be attacked that night. Fortunately, and I was on watch at the time, whenever they dropped from their quadcopter, was a thud and bounced off into the water. But that kind of alerted us to what was to come. And so it was about a four-hour ordeal with an explosion occurring about every 20 minutes.
There's been talk of Spanish or Italian or Turkish ships attempting to assist the flotilla in some way. And I believe these are military ships. What's the state of that or the prospects, if you can talk about that?
We've seen both of the Turkish ships today. One of the Italian ships I heard was with us in Crete. I have not seen the other Italian ship or the Spanish ship. I think it's, while it's a great show of solidarity, it still stands that, you know, a civilian volunteers are doing what our government should, and that is breaking the siege. So I don't want to sound ungrateful to these countries who stand in solidarity with us, but it shouldn't take civilians to do what they should be doing.
Yeah, and I just want to add to that the Italian ships were promised to or to the their delegates to protect them only after, you know, the 700 dock workers shut down the entire country. And so just like with all of these right-wing governments and Trump and Netanyahu, it's all stalling tactics. It's all for show. It's lies. Just when it comes to Trump and, you know, the ceasefire and anything, like, I'm just so tired of the world listening to Trump's lies and Netanyahu's lies, like this empty apology with these hollow words that have nothing backed by any kind of action. The world needs to move on from the axis of evil that is the United States and Israel, and move forward into the better world and be led by true humanitarian leaders like the Colombian president, President Petro. I just wanted to say thank you to Victor for coming on and saying what he did.
You're listening to Flashpoints. Let me just interrupt for a moment. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Philip Tottenham, and also we're speaking with Jessica Klotfelter. They are on the Gaza flotilla. I think it's called the Samud flotilla, and they are there to give protection, to give comfort, support, to the Gazans who are undergoing an extraordinary genocide that is funded by the United States in collaboration with Israel. We heard from the president of, from the prime minister of Israel today and Trump, and there is no indication that they were going to end this genocide anytime soon. So this flotilla is bearing witness for the world, which we wish that more of the world was watching. Sam, I'm turning it back to you for final questions for our guest.
Well, one interesting thing that happened when Petro was in the U.S. During the U.N. meetings, he laid out the Uniting for Peace case, and also, you know, vociferously criticized the U.S. government for its attacks in the Caribbean and so on. But then he ended up getting his visa revoked by the State Department for basically saying that U.S. soldiers should not heed illegal orders. And both of you being former Marines, I wanted you to perhaps chime in on that.
Absolutely. It's an abhorrent despotic abuse of power, which we've seen time and time again from this administration. And I just want to point out the oath that we take when we enter the military. There's a line that says that we will protect and defend our Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. So it is built into that oath that we take. So he was well within the right to say that. And I stand by that 100%.
Yeah, Sam, I just want to add that the last time that I was in your presence was in New York for the past, and there's a pretty symbolic vote that shows the line the rest of the world basically does is the United States, and just a few hours after that symbolic vote, Israel bombed Iran, and it looks like they're ramping to do that again and to undermine, any kind of progress on that front, and just kind of take away, not through like any kind of false distraction, but a real distraction, a real destruction of what's going on. But we want to draw people's eyes to Gaza and remember that, to remind people that they have been going through this for almost 2 years. It's insufferable. It's genocide, and we need people to act, and we need more and more pressure. We need to do what the Italians are doing and shut down the war machine inside the belly of the beast in the United States. We need to disrupt. We need all hands on deck to do this. We can't do this alone. We're doing the work of governments, and our governments have failed us and are not showing up. And the governments that are friendly to humanitarian cause, we really need to step up it and step up now.
You're talking about the port workers.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about that? A lot of people might not know.
Yeah, so the 700 Italian dock workers shut down basically the Italian economy and basically strong-armed the Italian government, who's the right-wing government, to basically provide these ships, which is, again, it's just a little appeasement, and we need to see something more profound happen, and to hold and strong-arm the leverage that workers do have that run the war machine, right, that run capitalism, to shut down business as usual, because we have that power as workers and as people. We way outnumber them, and we provide more than that they can ever provide for us.
I have to leave it right there. I can't tell you how much we appreciate you, Philip, and Jessica taking the time not only to be with us, to be out there on that flotilla, really in the most powerful way, speaking truth to power and putting your bodies on the line once again now as soldiers for peace, veterans for peace, doing extraordinary work and on the flotilla. We hope that we can continue the dialogue. Sam Husseini, as always, incredible privilege. We thank you for doing these Monday shows. It's all about what's going on now. And this continuing genocide in Gaza. It's difficult to get the word out, and we appreciate all the help we can get. You are listening to Flashpoints, to Genocide Watch Gaza with Sam Husseini. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Stay tuned for more to come. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Joining us now is LaShawn Harris. She's an associate professor of history at Michigan State University, the former managing and book review editor for the Journal of African American History, and a scholar of African American and Black women's histories. Her latest book is Eleanor Bumpers and the Police Killing That Galvanized New York City. Professor Harris, welcome to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us. And the book is very powerful and very timely. Thanks for writing it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the program, Dennis. I'm delighted to be speaking with you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And again, a very important book. I should say, just as a note, I was teaching at Bronx Regional High School the day after Eleanor Bumpers, some would say murdered, assassinated. One of the things we were actually getting ready to study Hiroshima. We had the director of the Hiroshima National Museum. But one of my students came in, raised his hand, said, "Did you hear about what happened to Eleanor Bumpers? She used to babysit for me." You know, and this is who then the press turned into a dangerous monster who the police were justified in assassinating her. I'm sorry, that's my word. But you were 10 years old when this unfolded. Yeah. You were getting ready to go trick-or-treating, but essentially the world of the Bronx was turned upside down. Tell us about your first knowledge of what happened to Mrs. Bumpers and how that led you to years of study and research and interviews to write this book.
Yes, thank you for that question. Yes, I live across the street from Eleanor Bumpers. From your for your listeners, this is in the Bronx. This is in the Morris Heights community off of University Avenue. I was 10 years old when this happened. Of course, I didn't know her personally. Actually, my parents, we had dogs in our home, and Eleanor Bumpers' daughter, Mary Bumpers, also had dogs. So my parents were friendly with Mary Bumpers, who was Eleanor Bumpers' daughter, who would go on to become an activist. So we knew Mary Bumpers through the community. So when all of this happened on October 29th, 1984, I was, a child getting ready for trick-or-treating, and, we were all preparing for that and couldn't go trick-or-treating in the neighborhood because there were cops and journalists and others kind of surrounding the neighborhood trying to understand what happened, reporters. So I grew up actually seeing this, New York Daily News 1980s photo of Eleanor Bumpers. I grew up hearing her name in, hip-hop songs, and I also grew up seeing her name in films, particularly Spike Lee's She's Gotta Have It and his 1989 film, Do the Right Thing. So what occurred to me after all of those years of just hearing about her, seeing that New York Daily News photo, I really wanted to know who she was as a person before she was killed in her apartment. I was also concerned about how it impacted my Bronx community and the greater New York community. And what did the legal justice organization look like for her? Like, what did that movement look like for, someone who was, a Black woman, disabled, working poor, et cetera. So I was really interested in her interior life, the legal justice campaign, as well as the various groups of grassroots activism that was sparked because of her killing.
Tell us, one of the things, I thought I knew a lot about this case, but I learned a great deal reading your book. And part of it is, the context and the way in which you humanize her and tell us about her story. So she came from the South, migrated to New York City during World War II, and she really tried to make a life for herself, for her family, and struggled in the context of extraordinary racism and many challenges. I love how you say cooking was her love language.
Yeah, I mean, Eleanor Bumpers was, her real name is Elna Gray Williams. And she's, you know, her birthday was on August 22nd, she was born in 1918, from the Jim Crow South, as you said. She's part of a generation of Black women who are migrating during the Second Great Migration of the 1940s. She was a loving mother. She was a protective mother. She was someone who loved to cook. And she loved to dance. She loved flowers. This was someone who also experienced, you know, moments of trauma, isolation, unfulfilled desires. She was a single mother. Her own mother died when she was at least 9 years old. She was arrested several times in the 1940s and 1970s. But this is someone who, despite, as you said, you know, Jim Crow North, despite all of the municipal neglect, this is someone who struggled to take care of her family. And she loved her children fiercely. So her life is both one of, you know, survival, but it's also one of resilience. You know, just in terms of taking care of herself and also taking care of her children.
Let's spend a few minutes on the eviction and the system that evicted her, some would say assassinated her, attempted to degrade her. Her daughter was very brave, one of her daughters, to fight for her reputation and stuff. But talk about it's police violence, consistent, systematic police violence that ultimately cost her her life. She did not have to die.
Yeah. So prior to October 29th, 1984, when the police actually go into the apartment, it's important for your audience to know that there were two different police officers on the day of the eviction. There was the Housing Authority police, which was not connected to the NYPD. And then there was the NYPD, their emergency service unit. And this is the police that's supposed to be highly skilled. They're trained. These are the cops that are put in charge of dealing with persons with mental health issues. They carry a lot of weaponry on them, shotguns, mace, all types of things. But prior to them actually going into the apartment, Eleanor Bumpers had already faced various forms of municipal neglect. So in July of 1984, she was living in a housing project, but she stopped paying rent. She didn't pay any rent between July 1984 and October 1984. And the Housing Authority sent eviction notices out. It's unclear whether she received those eviction notices. It's unclear if she did, whether she read them or not, because she was dealing with a mental health condition. And somewhere around that time, we see the Housing Authority social workers actually attempting to get Eleanor Bumpers some services. They understand that there's some type of mental health issue, but they don't know exactly what's going on. And what they do is they pass her case off to the Human Resources Administration, which is essentially the city social workers. And in that department, they essentially dropped the ball, because her eviction could have been prevented if the city would have paid the rent. Now, the city had been in the business of paying people's rent in the past, those folks who are economically strapped or people who may have a mental health issue. But for some reason, that did not happen in Eleanor Bumpers' case. So before police actually go in, she had already suffered neglect and abandonment from the city. What the Housing Authority does is they put Eleanor in the police's crosshairs. And that's done because they think that she's violent. And, you know, there was these rumors that she, you know, had wielded a knife at folks. And there were other rumors that she was boiling lye. So when the police actually go in, there's this assumption about who she is. They don't see her as a, you know, a grandmother. They don't see her as an elderly person. They don't see her as someone who is, you know, needs help. They see her as someone who is potentially violent. So again, just to kind of stress the point that she was already in danger when she was refused city services between July of 1984 and October of 1984.
And of course, we have to remind people that she also nearly lost her life and her family in a fire that left her, you know, with very little. And there was not a great deal of help in that regard in terms of, you know, getting the help she might need. Let me let people know that we're talking about Tell Her Story, Eleanor Bumpers and the Police Killing That Galvanized New York City. The author is LaShawn Harris, professor at university and has been studying the story for years. You were affected by it as a child, but you followed it through, and it seemed to become a focus of your life for several decades. And it does appear in the context of an emerging movement against state-sponsored violence against black women. You want to talk a little bit about that in the context of the impact of the story and what happened and the way people rose up to support her and her cause?
Sure. Sure. I mean, the campaign for her is really similar, and I say this in the book. I mean, it's probably New York City's first anti-police brutality campaign centered on a black woman. So for the 1980s, the Eleanor Bumpers case appears to be like an early iteration of what Kimberly Crenshaw, legal scholar, and the African-American policy forum will call the hashtag Say Her Name movement in 2014, which is a movement dedicated to bringing visibility to violence against black women and girls. The same thing is happening during the 1980s as it pertains to Eleanor Bumpers. And the case is really a case that is amid a host of other cases of police brutality or white violence against black people. So the cases I'm referring to are Michael Stewart in 1983, Edmund Perry in 1985. These are New York cases. The Michael Griffin case in 1986. This is a case of white violence. Yusuf Hawkins, another case of white violence. And other black women. Sharon Walker was killed 2 months after Eleanor Bumpers in Queens by a black police officer. Yvonne Smallwood was killed. Died in police custody in the late 1980s. So, and those cases received garnered a little bit of attention, but not like the Bumpers case. What's so interesting about the Bumpers case is that it galvanizes New Yorkers in a whole host of ways. So people are, you know, forming organizations such as the Eleanor Bumpers Justice Committee. They are writing letters to, you know, city officials, state officials, you know, children and teenagers, like the ones that you taught at the Bronx Regional High School, are making, you know, a documentary. Children are, you know, writing poems for Eleanor. So there's a community-wide, even beyond the Bronx, where you see people pushing for justice for Eleanor Bumpers. And what they're demanding collectively is that her killer, Stephen Sullivan, be terminated by the NYPD. They're demanding that, you know, Bronx County District Attorney Mario Merola to convene a grand jury, which he eventually does, and charge Sullivan with homicide. They want the welfare workers and the New York City Housing Authority to be held and anyone who had anything to do with the eviction to be held responsible for the eviction. They want a federal probe, and the U.S. attorney at the time was Rudy Giuliani. They want Mayor Koch to immediately release a multi-city agency report on the eviction, which he eventually does. And again, when we think about activists, this is, you know, ordinary working class grassroots people, black men, white men, black women, I mean, people of all racial and ethnic backgrounds coming to you know, say her name and tell her story and to really fight for justice. But this looks like, you know, letter writing campaigns, protests in the streets,
yes,
talking to media, different types of media, the New York Amsterdam News, the City Sun, you know, just really getting the word out there. And her daughter, Mary Bumpers, I mean, fights for her mother fiercely. I mean, this woman, you know, her mother has just been killed and she's grieving and she's also fighting, you know, the police. The police union, and any other detractors who believe that, you know, her mother was violent and deserved to be killed.
And you really spent, I really admire that you took the time, many interviews over many years with Mary Bumpers, who was taking on the entire police force, because once you disagree with the police force or the official story, you're going to face all kinds of hell, and that includes all kinds of violence. I mean, it's incredible that she was able to keep going, to hold her head high and fight that fight.
Yeah, she said that she told me, she's the second oldest. Her sister, Fanny Mae Hayes, died before seeing Eleanor Bumpers' first daughter. She died before seeing any justice for her mother. And Mary said that her sister said that you have to fight for our mother. You have to be her voice. And again, this is someone who is, you know, she has a high school diploma. Mary Bumpers was out of work. You know, she was unemployed. And this is someone who doesn't have an activist background. So she really had to kind of take,
yes,
a crash course in how to become an activist.
Yes.
Yes. But this is someone who, you know, who wanted the city and really the nation, the world, to understand what police violence had done to their family. And they didn't, and she didn't want this to, she didn't want any of her family to feel the pain that her family was feeling. And she put that out there, you know, with these political speeches, but it was also bearing her soul about how she had lost, how they had lost their mother.
Yeah, there was, I'm telling you, there was something about that time. I'm remembering that my students, the first thing they did is take our cameras. It was a film history course.
Yeah.
And they took the cameras right to the keyhole and started filming the next,
yeah,
day through the keyhole.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that a couple of my students in that class became very good journalists as a result of seeing this, experiencing this, and being able to fight and do something about it. And that was a gift for people, for young people, to see that they could stand up. There was a fight. Let's spend a few minutes on the murder trial. I'm blanking on the cop's name. Sullivan, was it?
Stephen Sullivan. But let me just say this really quickly.
Yes, please,
about
go
your
on.
Students. Your students, I believe, I would say, are the first journalists, and I'm going to call them journalists because that's the type of work that they were doing.
Wow.
They are the first journalists to really capture the voices of that community. Because as
oh
you
my
said,
God.
They were there,
you know,
the next day. They are the first journalists to capture. Because if you look at the documentary, I've only seen what I could find online. Like, they interview Mary Bumpers. They're interviewing,
yeah,
people who live in the Sedgwick houses. They go to one of the meetings, and they are the ones who are capturing the anger.
I remember one of my students asked one of the people at that community meeting, you know, what do you think about the way they treated Mrs. Bumpers? And the response was from this person who was at this meeting, did you hear about that animal that escaped from the Bronx Zoo? They shot her with a sleep dart, and they treated the animal better than Mrs. Bumpers. And with rage, right. This is the kind of stuff set my students on fire. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
It was gold for me as a scholar, because I'm reading like Jimmy Breslin and other reporters who have great, you know, they're doing great interviews, but the students, you know, those interviews with people who actually lived in the building and on her floor was gold.
It was her babysitter. My student, right. It was his babysitter until she had arthritis and couldn't move around.
That's right. Yes.
Tell us about Stephen Sullivan.
Stephen Sullivan, at that time in 84, was, a veteran cop. I believe he had at least 10 years in the NYPD. This is someone who doesn't live in the city. He lived outside, lived outside of the city. Dedicated husband, two children, and a former Marine. And on that particular day, when the emergency service unit goes to the Eleanor Bumpers house, Stephen Sullivan does not even have the shotgun. Another police officer had the shotgun. The other police officer's shoe was untied, and Stephen Sullivan says, "Your shoe's untied." And the guy says, "Can you hold the shotgun and let me tie my shoe?" And Stephen Sullivan just ends up having the gun. So it was just by happenstance that he had the shotgun. And they go in and she's shot twice, once in the right hand and the other in the chest. And he's not indicted. He's indicted. There's a grand jury convening in the fall of 1984, little into 1985. And by the end of January of 1985, he is indicted by a Bronx grand jury. That indictment is dismissed by a judge. It goes to the state appellate court. The dismissed indictment is upheld, and by the time it gets to the Court of Appeals, then November, maybe the fall of 1986, the court reinstates the indictment. So it's a three-year legal battle to get Stephen Sullivan to trial. He ends up going to trial in January of 1987. And I don't know if I should, I think most people probably know, they probably know what happens, but I'll just leave it there.
People should get the book and read this important book about Eleanor Bumpers, about the nature of police violence, systematic police violence in New York City. And it is was very troubling to me and my students that it was relatively close range, two shots with a shotgun. The first one, as you say, essentially blew her hand off. That wasn't enough. That this arthritic grandmother, they needed a second shot from the shotgun. This was the message.
The story is that, the blast to the hand, which blew off three fingers. So it would seem like it would be impossible to hold something with three fingers blown off. But the story is three fingers were blown off, and she was still, according to police reports, she was still holding the knife and still flailing. So that was the reason that they gave for the two shots the second shot to the chest. And she doesn't die immediately. Wow. She actually dies when she gets to the hospital. Actually, she's semi-conscious after they shoot her in the chest.
Amazing. Well, this is, as you say, this is a significant case in the focusing in on and resisting, calling attention to the systematic police violence sustained at the highest, in the highest levels of the police community. we're hoping that it will get a little better. I'm concerned given the current atmospheric pressure that we're living under, that these are not going to be good times for the people who are represented in this book and who, you know, I mean, these are tough times. But again, let me tell people, tell her story, Eleanor Bumpus and the police killing that galvanized New York City. And a very important book that you've written, and we thank appreciate you. That you took the time out to be with us again. Thank you very much. Really appreciate
thank you.
Good work.
Thank you for your activism.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for now. Be safe.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.